Cliffcentral. The revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
Cliffcentral.com.
Hello and welcome to it. You are now listening to the Weekly Mashup with your host, Candace Mama, and my co-host, Mr. Tumisho Masha. So, I'm sure many of you have heard about the controversy that has been circulating in the media lately about Pastor André Olivier. And to those of you who have not heard what Pastor Olivier has said and why he finds himself in hot water, I will tell you some of the statements he's made, and my co-host will come in and tell us where he stands and why he believes what he believes. So, on a service on Sunday, Pastor Olivier, in the middle of his preaching, said a couple of controversial statements, basically about black people. And some of the statements many people have deemed inappropriate, ignorant, and racist. So, some of the statements he said are, if you are black, God will send you white people. Then he said, don't say the problem in South Africa is the white people. No, we are not. We have contributed to this nation and we still do. Then another statement he said was, if you want to know why white people still have money, it is because they work. So don't drive them away. They can speak into your life, he said. Wow. So there were a couple of others that followed. In the middle of the sermon, he went on to say, now don't get too stressed. If you are white, God will send you black people. God will use people unlike you to do something in you. And he said, don't push them away. Let them be the voice of God to you. At this point, there were just a couple of applause, and which he followed up with, are you all okay this morning? I must say, I get very annoyed when I watch television and I see people saying that whites are the problem in the country. No, we are not. We helped build this nation, he then went on to say. We took nothing from no one. Maybe the law favored us, but we worked, and I am still working. And when you tell me I need to share my wealth, what are you suggesting? Are you suggesting I give away some of it? Are you giving any of yours away? Excuse me. Now, when you listen to those statements alone, you'd think to yourself, well, clearly there's nothing to debate here. These are clearly racial statements, but if not racial, maybe deeply ignorant. Because I'd look at it, when I heard it at first, I thought to myself, you know what? Maybe he was just having a moment of weakness. And what he said, he has said that it has been quoted out of context. And I'm sure his intentions that morning when he woke up wasn't, I'm going to piss off as many black people, you know, as I can today. I think it was a moment of weakness and a moment of not thinking through exactly what you want to say. So when my studio host gets in, he will discuss his standing, because he has been under boiling water from what we will call Black Twitter, who have been cruel and I don't know, guys. Sometimes you guys need to express yourself better, hey? Like, you don't need to be so mean. You can disagree with someone without being so cruel and rude. And so, you know, so he went on to explain himself on another platform yesterday. And today, I think it will give him a bigger and a broader audience to speak to and explain himself and explain what exactly he meant when he was defending Pastor Olivier, because I think a lot of us tend to forget that these two people have a personal relationship. And I think they clearly have a relationship that transcended the service. Therefore, he was speaking from his own experience of the pastor. And we are not saying what he's saying is right or wrong. But, I mean, I do not want to be his mouthpiece. And he just joined us in studio. So so hopefully he'll be able to answer for himself in a little bit. Haiti.
How are you doing, Candy?
I'm good. Wow. You really made us wait there. My goodness, that was the longest intro to anything I've ever done.
Well done.
So I've basically...
You're fantastic. So you're basically saying, hey, guys, how
yes.
you doing?
So basically, we had just broken down what had happened with the Rivers Church. And we were saying that, you know, I feel that Black Twitter has been rather cruel and how they express themselves. But I think it's very important for you to express yourself in a way that people can understand where you are coming from. Firstly, that you guys have a personal relationship, Pastor Olivier, of course, being your spiritual father, and where you are coming from.
Well, you know, I think here's the thing, right?
Yes.
I think a lot of people, and this is what they were saying on Black Twitter, and this is their rationale. And even, I'd say, there was a spokesman on from the EFF who was on 702.
Oh, yes.
And what people seem to assume is, just because someone is nice to you for a little bit, or is nice to you and your friends does not make them non-racist. So you have no right to say that you know somebody well enough to say that they're not a racist, which I find kind of weird, because I'm sitting here next to you.
Yes.
And if anything had to happen,
yeah,
and someone says, you know, Candace is this kind of person,
yeah,
and I turn around and say, I don't know her to be like that.
Yes,
I don't believe that
personal
she's that
perspective.
Person.
Yeah.
And then someone says, but just because she was nice to you or whatever doesn't mean she's not an abuser or whatever.
Oh, yes.
You know
yes,
what I mean?
Yes, yes.
And I also think that we seem to not be able to have a right to express ourselves at the moment in this country to say, I don't believe someone is like this, especially when it comes to race issues.
Yes.
If you're black, you're expected to jump on the bandwagon, pick up a tire,
a baton,
a baseball bat or whatever, a gun, fire. And if someone is accused of being a racist, jump on the bandwagon, join the mob and set fire to the whole thing.
Yeah.
And if you don't agree with that, with the mob,
they will set you on fire.
They will set you on fire. But yeah, that's okay, because that's at some point people have to make a choice and say, you know what, not on my watch.
Yes.
And whether I'm wrong, whether I'm right, it doesn't even matter. The point is, I believe that a man might have said something that maybe he could have elaborated on, but it certainly doesn't make him a racist. And I don't believe that he thinks that black people in this country are not hardworking and we do not deserve to have economic freedom of some sort and redistribution of that wealth. I certainly don't believe that at all.
But
because he said that many times on that very same pulpit.
Yes. Would it be fair to say, though, that his statements came across as deeply ignorant of someone who wasn't necessarily acknowledging the history of the country that he is currently residing in?
I think his statements came across as, how do I say this? Almost, I think it's sometimes when people get used to a certain kind of audience, they might relax, they might be a little bit relaxed.
But 10,000. His church houses 10,000 people. So
yeah, but not, you don't get 10,000 at the same time.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. So I have a feeling this is what happens, and I understand this because, you know, being either on a public platform or doing something that is live, and sometimes you tend to push certain boundaries.
Yes.
And I think that he should have elaborated and said, listen, what I'm saying is that black people work very hard as well. And he did say that, actually. He said he acknowledged that there are lots of hardworking black people.
Yeah.
My point is, I'm trying to say to you guys, because that was part of the sermon, we need to start realizing that we need each other.
Yes.
Number one.
Yeah.
Number two, we should address the land issue.
Mm.
We should address white privilege. But don't see all white people having something as they were just given.
But within, I listened to portions of this recording, of course, the sensationalized portions. But from my understanding and from what I've listened to, there's a point in the sermon where he acknowledges that, you know, he had gone off script. He was now not speaking according to the planned scriptures that he had planned to, you know, preach on that day. And sometimes I tend to ask myself that when you're a pastor, we do hold you to a different regard than the rest of us, because you are now a representation of God on earth. And
not really, you're just a guy.
No, but you are
word.
Giving yourself, no, but you are giving
you're
yourself the authority. No, but when you're a pastor, to make sure you give yourself the authority of speaking on behalf of. So you are influencing a number of people using religious principles and teaching them the word of God. And I'm not saying pastors have to be perfect. What I am saying, though, is that they need to be more careful than the rest of us, and they cannot be held to the same regard as the rest of us.
Of course, you know? I agree with you.
So when he went on to say that he was digressing from the sermon in order to air out what he was clearly feeling on that particular day, that's a bit problematic, and I feel like that's where the uproar was coming from.
No,
that,
I
why are you giving
you.
Personal opinions when you should just be giving us the word?
I agree with you, and I think that's something that I think that even the staff at Rivers should have addressed, because here's the other thing that I heard that happened at the 11:15 you know, sermon.
Yes.
And then I think it didn't change much to the later sermon. So I'm like, but where were the gatekeepers? You know what I'm saying? And where were the people who should have said, hey, dude, you can't just say it like that.
Yeah.
I know what you're trying to say, but what you're trying to say and what it sounds like are two very different things.
Yeah.
If you're going to say something like that and if you're going to lead us there, you need to have that background.
You need to add context.
You need to add context, exactly. And I think that's something that from my point of view as a congregant, I'm just a congregant, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm not a spokesperson for the church.
Are you sure you don't do the voiceovers for the church?
I've done a lot of church announcements for many churches. Yeah. But no, I don't actually. At the moment, I haven't done that for a while. I just haven't had the time. But that's part of volunteering, you know?
Yes.
Churches survive because people volunteer. And a lot of people think big churches are just running on all this money and all that. But it's because a lot of people put in their time and effort to volunteer and give.
Mm.
And that's why things work. But nonetheless, what I'm saying is, you also need to be able to call someone who is a leader to order when they say things that
are out of order.
Mm-hmm. Especially for the sake of the church.
Yes.
And I think that should have happened. And personally, I haven't had a chance to speak to him.
Oh.
But usually, you know, if I bump into him after a sermon, like you bump into a pastor and you say, "Hey, how you doing?" And he might be like, "How was that today?" And you might say, "You know, I would have done this and that right there."
Mm.
I didn't get that chance, unfortunately.
Yes. But
if I did, I would have said, "Listen." Even when I heard it the first time, I would have said, "Listen, you really need to like be careful how you say that."
Yeah.
I think I understand where you're coming from, but you can have a lot of people be very upset about this.
Okay, can I just say, when you say you understand where he's coming from,
by the way.
Thank
Did
you.
Tell you that today?
Everyone told me that today.
Yes,
but don't
but
digress.
Tell you how fantastic you look, though.
I mean, don't digress.
Can you stand up for the people so they can see?
Stop it. Okay. No, but on the point where you say that you understand where he's coming from, I have no idea where he's coming from, because I feel that in South Africa, yes, there's a lot of people that tend to say reckless things, and they tend to justify it by saying, "But no, but I'm a nice one. Like, look, I've got 10 black friends. Like, I'm not speaking from a place of racism or ignorance."
I understand.
I feel like he was coming across as very entitled, number one. Number two, the statement in itself, whereby he declares that he has accumulated wealth, but he's not willing to share his wealth because he doesn't understand how exactly he's supposed to distribute this wealth. And then he went on to, in one of his defense interviews, he said he feeds 36,000 children. Now, a church is a business. It runs according to, it is governed and it runs according to compliance.
Right?
Yes, it runs. And feeding children when you're a church is a CSI scheme. It is a corporate social investment whereby you are being seen as doing something good. Therefore, we are more willing to invest in you as a company or as a business. So for him to come out and say, "We feed people," great, well done, round of applause. But you're clearly not empowering, because we do not need you to keep giving us food. We need you to empower us, invest in our education, invest in our growth, and don't tell us we're lazy.
You know what? No, he didn't say anyone was lazy.
Yeah, but I mean, it was implied. Because he was saying white people work hard for their money.
So by that,
and clearly
by that
black,
it doesn't
people
mean
don't.
Black people don't. Just because I say one thing, I don't say the other.
To be sure, if let's
I say,
not joke.
No. Let's be real. Let's be real for a second.
Yeah.
If I say, you know what? Men earn more than women because they generally don't have to fall pregnant and have that gap where they are on maternity leave. And generally they work harder. Or they work hard. Not even they work harder. They just work hard. Does that imply that women work less hard?
Yes.
No.
That is the implication, because you are actually, it is just a coward's way of not saying what they want to say. Because, you know,
well, I don't think so.
You know,
I think
you
women
know
work very hard.
No. Yeah,
you're,
no, no, no.
You're hard
I know.
Working. You know what I'm saying? I'm going to say that right now. I mean, you're the reason why we have the show, isn't it?
Yeah. But seriously speaking, I think the biggest problem that a lot of people are having, and this is what I want us to go to, is the fact that I feel a lot of people, especially white South Africans in this particular scenario, do not have a context of why. Because a lot of people say apartheid is over, get over it.
I hate that.
Jewish people, you know, are still allowed to speak of the Holocaust and the impact the Holocaust has had on them. We are only 20 years out of apartheid. My dad is directly affected that I do not have a father today.
I don't even know if you're first generation or you're just that generation.
I am the generation that
Your
got directly
first
impacted.
Generation. Yeah.
Exactly. I'm the generation that got directly impacted by apartheid. And so are many, many black South Africans. Mm. So we are not starting life on the same playing field here. So as a black South African, when I go into the workforce, I am not starting on the same playing field as Susan, who grew up, you know, in a suburb her whole life, and she's been coddled her whole life, and she was raised by two parents. It's just not the same.
And she lives closer to work.
And she lives closer to work. She lives closer to school.
And she doesn't have to take a taxi to get to work. She just gets in a car and drives to work. You took like four taxis.
You know, and I think sometimes in society, we fail to acknowledge our own privilege. I mean, I sit in a position of privilege. The way I speak, I know I'm received better because I correlate better to whiteness. The way people view me, I'm a closer. Oh, please. the way people view me, you know, they're more likely to work with me because I am a better representation. You're not really. I mean, you decided to screw us over and go on Power FM.
They asked me to go there. I mean, like, I asked you to come to work. I had to do this. Okay. Anyway.
No, but seriously, I think we need to clear that up, because as soon as everyone thinks we're all equal, because I feel like sometimes people tend to say that I'm white and I come from a poor background. Hello, we are not the same when we come into poor backgrounds. I am psychologically damaged from my past. I am financially damaged from my past. I'm still living with the repercussions of being treated as less than human because of the color of my skin. So we are not equal. We are not starting on the same playing field.
I totally agree with you on that one. And I think that in general, And maybe that's the problem, because we had a whole TRC, right?
Mm-hmm.
About death and killings and murders, but we never had an economic TRC. And I think that's what we need right now.
Yeah.
And I think this notion, and I remember I've spoken to you about it before, that a lot of people say, one, apartheid is over, get over it, but we don't want to see any more struggle movies or struggle issues in the media and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Is what is causing and compounding the very problem you're talking about? Because we don't talk about it in a way that people can just see. You know, I find that film and television, even if it's dramatized, kind of helps you understand the context. It kind of helps you see from another person's perspective. I think it's one thing to have carte blanche or to have some news show that's a documentary that shows you what you just spoke about now.
Yeah.
But it doesn't deal with emotions, does it? It just shows you Sophie getting into a taxi and then getting to another taxi and waking up at 4 a.m. and boiling water by a charcoal fire outside before she washes. And it shows you, let's call her Gail, who just gets into the shower and 30 minutes later, she's ready to go. The helper has made her some breakfast.
Yeah.
And then she just gets into her car and 15 minutes later, she's at work.
Yeah.
And then when Sophie gets to work, 30 minutes late, it's like, you're always late, Sophie. Mm. This has got to stop, you know, like you got to be. And it's like, but you don't understand what it took for her to get here. She like woke up at 4 a.m. Seeing it as a documentary is just showing us what
the
it
reality is.
But dramatizing is helping us feel Sophie's emotion. And we need to do more of that and conscientize a lot more. And I'm going to say it like it is, white people, to understand that, guys, this is the reality of this country. And when you speak about some of these issues, you need to put that context first, that I understand where you're coming from. And having said that, I think that that is something that is good about what has happened with our pastor, is that he can learn now. That
actually, do you think he's going to learn, though? Because I feel like he released a tweet whereby he apologizes. But I feel like this was an Oscar Pistorius apology. Like, guys, look, I'm kind of like, sorry, but please take me back into society as a servant. And I mean, I don't feel like it's fair for him to be, you know, going back on the pulpit with the same prejudice and then saying that the devil is interfering in his work.
You know what?
The devil's not interfering in your work. You are interfering in your damn work.
From my point of view, I hope he does learn. And if he doesn't, it'll be very unfortunate, because...
Are you going to help him learn, though? Because you were one of the advocates of his, you know, protecting
him. I thought I was doing that, but clearly there's more schooling that I need to keep doing, you know?
Yeah.
I am going to help him learn.
Mm.
And if he doesn't, I can only just say, you know what? He's a grown-up man as well.
Yeah.
So I have to step back and say, you are a victim of your own sometimes doing.
Yeah.
You know? The reason why I felt, and whether right or wrong, I had to do something and say something, was, I feel like sometimes if you know somebody, if you feel you know somebody, and I guess whether they're being attacked for real or on social media, physically or on the media, how do you say that?
In the viral world.
You kind of have to stop and say, hang on a second, you know? Can we just... Let's pause.
Mm.
Let's do it properly.
Mm.
Let's rather have a court case like maybe Oscar did or whatever, and check out the facts. But in the meantime, someone always has to stand in the gap for someone else. And I hope someone will be able to stand in the gap one day for me, if ever I'm in a lot of trouble. Maybe that's what I'm doing. I'm getting my standing in the gap credits out there. And I felt that, heck, I'm in public media as well, so it's up to people like me to say something.
But now, going forward,
I'm going to say, going forward, if somebody doesn't learn from something like that and does not show that I was right about them, then there's nothing I can do about it, right?
Yeah. No, and I'm all for, you know, fighting for the underdog in a lot of cases. But don't you feel that you should have used your platform instead of saying, you should have probably articulated that you know him as a man, and from your experience of him, this is not how you have experienced him at all. And you, firstly, you say that, and then afterwards, you can go on to your Twitter debate or your Twitter war. But as far as saying, you know, this man is not like this, and you're fighting profusely to protect his reputation, wouldn't it have been better to pick up the phone, get him in a one-on-one meeting, school him on his lack of knowledge about South African history, and then only jump onto Twitter and say that, look, I spoke to this man one-on-one and he's having regrets, or he's...
Hindsight is a wonderful thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And if only we could do everything in hindsight.
Yeah.
But we can't do everything in hindsight. Now, I already just sent two tweets, by the way. I never responded after that.
Yeah.
Candice is making funny faces.
I'm just saying, I told you so.
She's that wife who, she's like that wife. Not, she's not that wife, not all, but she's like that wife who's like, you shouldn't have done that, honey. I told you it was going to end badly. Now look at you, you're in hospital.
Yeah.
You're lying here.
That's completely
because
what
you stood
I'm
up
doing.
For this man and they beat you up along with
him. Yeah, because why were you standing up for
and
him?
Now I don't know how we're going to pay for these medical bills, because you know your kind of work. If you don't go to work, you don't get paid. Somebody has to stand. And I only did like two tweets, yeah. Guys. And I was just saying, like, as in my opinion, this guy's not what you're saying he is, because it's a big word, you know, to call someone a racist,
it's
like calling a man a rapist. It's Ooh. Like, it's really like the same thing.
You think
you can't get, you can't one day not be that.
I feel like people have become desensitized to racism, though. I feel in a lot of ways. I feel in a lot of ways, like, people now are becoming more vocal about their racial discrimination. And sometimes when people who are in a position of power and influence over a majority of different types of individuals, and they spread speech that is inaccurate and uneducated, that sometimes that causes more harm to society. And therefore, the title of racist is the least of his concern. But the amount of people that went home that day and agreed with what he was saying and were like, yeah, you know, the pastor said black folk just need to work harder and whatever, you know, it's very difficult. It's difficult to defend that.
I'm just like... You're right. It's very difficult to defend that. It's a tough one.
It is a tough one.
I don't know how we're going to get past this. I don't even
Education.
Really know how or why I jumped into the fray.
Yeah, no one does.
And I'm not sure if I can say that I'll never do that again.
Not even me.
Yeah, not even you. I remember when Gareth had his problems as well. But I find that it is that serious. That you think we've become desensitized. I think... If you're not something and someone calls you that, it's very painful and hurtful.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if you have good intentions. I can imagine if someone called me a rapist, it would be devastating for me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because that's the last thing that I'd want to be.
Mm. But you wouldn't put yourself in a position where you'd have to be accused of such a thing.
I think it's very easy
don't you think
in
a world? No, don't you think in a world whereby all of us are constantly being... aware of our position in the world and how we're being perceived, that you wouldn't put yourself in a situation whereby a woman can call you a rapist, just as much as you wouldn't put yourself in a situation where you can be called a racist. So I mean, it's very situational. Why are you putting yourself in those situations where you can be labeled such?
I think people are human beings, and one hotel room incident could lead to someone saying this happened when it didn't.
No, but
I'm not saying that I do that all the time. I'm just saying that's how it could happen.
No,
that's
of
how
course.
I see it happening.
Of course it could happen, but I'm saying you would try your best to avoid situations like that. So I'm just saying that it is not the same as being called a rapist, but as well, in the same breath, like, you don't continue to speak on something that you can clearly see makes people uncomfortable and then not apologize, because until a sincere apology has been issued, I feel like a lot of people are going to be holding on to this incident, and he will be placed in the category of the Sudwana Bay hotel owner as, you know, a racist. And yeah, so anyway,
we've got our guests in
you've
the studio.
Got yes I'm and sorry I'm you like, guys
and we're just having this conversation between us. It's like so rude.
You guys are just taking this in. I'm so sorry.
Hey guys, how you doing?
Good, how are
I'm
you
sorry doing? She gets like this. I can't control her.
Well,
oh,
yeah,
it's wonderful. Thank
because
you,
some people just put themselves in hot water. But go on.
it's an honor to be here, to get to listen to, I think, a very, very important dialogue, right, wrong, or something in between. I think it's something the world needs to address right now.
Yeah.
Coming from the United States, it's something we need to address. And so, no, thank you for inviting us here.
Yeah.
Of course. Sorry, guys. Introduce yourself. So introduce yourself, and then we'll get into how I met you guys and why I invited you into the studio.
You got it. My name is Drew Descaray, from the United States. Grew up in California. Just finished up first year university at Santa Clara University in California.
Yeah.
And I'm here with my very, very good friend, Michael Bacon.
Yeah, everyone, I'm Michael Bacon. I had the honor of going to high school with Drew in California, but now I just finished up my first year at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C.
How old are you guys?
Yeah.
I am 19. And Drew...
Also 19.
Oh, wow.
But can I tell you guys where they're
so
living?
Much potential and promise. Where are they living?
They're living in Soweto.
It's a great place to live,
Soweto. It's beautiful, right?
I wish I lived there.
Okay.
I really do. It's just, it's like, you know, it's a bit far.
I feel like I'm glad you don't live there because you would have been stoned. So I met you guys at the Nelson Mandela Foundation when we were listening to a debate about fallism, right? And you guys were so into this debate. I mean, you guys were taking notes. You were so enthusiastic. And when we got to speaking, why did you guys come to South Africa?
I actually think it fits really well with the conversation we're having right now.
Yeah.
I think we, particularly with the power of social media, we do a lot of talking.
Oh, yeah.
Right now, myself included. I think our position in the U.S. allows us to do a lot of talking, or what seems to be talking.
Yeah.
I think it's easy to hold positions of power for a long, long time. And so my hope was to start listening to the best of my ability. It was something that really prompted our travel was we're actually traveling back. This will be the third time. Michael's been here the second time. We're coming back to continue to develop relationships. And what's something we call the Simunye Project.
Yes.
Which we'll explain a little bit more. But this idea, we are one, something we wanted to learn about.
Yes.
That I feel like we've already, through trade relationships, we've already fostered relationships around the world. And so to not honor them, to not try to listen to them, to not try to engage them is... you know, a form of negligence.
Yes, yes.
Go ahead.
Okay.
You had a question.
Yeah. No, but when you guys started this, I mean, you guys are young, you know, to leave your hometown and come so far. I mean, what is the end objective of your project? Like, what do you want people to take away from the work you guys are doing?
Well, I think that's something we're still figuring out, especially as we do listen to the voices of Soweto. But I hope when we say Simunye, what that means... We've also learned it sort of can often be an overused and misused word. We hope to realize that, especially through storytelling, one, how much we are in relationship, as Drew noted, in ways that we don't quite understand or realize, whether it's economic or trade. But also to realize that as a part of oneness, we are individuals, we are A1, and we have unique backgrounds, unique stories. But I hope that recognizing that will hopefully make the oneness of us as a whole a little bit broader, sort of like the picture, that recognizing the individual and their story and the pixel of a picture will hopefully paint a more clear picture as a whole.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what has been your impression so far of a place like Soweto? And had you, in fact, how has that changed from what you had seen in the media before you came to South Africa?
Well, whenever I tell people I'm going to Soweto, the first reaction is, oh my gosh, are you going to be okay? What's going on? Why? What's Soweto? My goodness. Even the first time I actually went to South Africa in 2014, when I handed over my passport to the customs guard, he asked me where I was going. And when I said Soweto, he gave me, oh my gosh, why? Why would you go there? That's the ghetto. But I think that's sort of a big reason also why I wanted to come back, to learn more, not only from the people, but use their message, the narrative of Soweto, each of its individuals, to tell me about my own self.
Okay.
Soweto actually sort of taught me how I have shortened my own story. As someone who is half Filipino, my mom's from the Philippines, realizing how I had shortened my own story to just this person without realizing my own background, without saying, oh my gosh, my mom is... what it was her life like at the Philippines.
Yeah.
So it is a place that means a lot to me, not only because of its people, but because their stories in particular play a role in how we can, a lot of times shorten the stories of others.
Hmm.
Wow. And yourself, young man, why did you decide to come to Soweto?
The first time we came to Soweto, we actually came together, developed a lot of really strong relationships, a lot of strong friendships that Michael has helped maintain over the past few years. So I wanted to come back to somewhere I knew, was familiar with. And I think I also wanted to come back somewhere where I felt like we, again, back to the listening and to the learning, I wanted to go somewhere where I felt like we'd be challenged to get to know people in a different way. I think Soweto in particular, you hear a lot of the statistics of the demographics. And I actually found interesting that, you know, downtown streets of Johannesburg, traditionally more metropolitan, kind of a more of a global city.
Yeah.
Actually, we were talking to Candace about, actually felt...
more disconnected.
Yeah, less well-known than Soweto, that I think I wanted to test this theory that if... you know, you share stories mutually. This isn't one side. And we've really struggled with that, you know, back home. You know, what are you doing? What is the project? What's the outcome? Because I think a lot of in the U.S., people like to see, okay.
A result.
This nonprofit NGO comes in and saves the day. And we really, that's actually a big objective for ours is this. I really want this to be mutual, to disprove a lot of the service trip Facebook status inequality that I think actually perpetuates, despite the wall you build or the ditch you dig, really perpetuates some really, really insidious sort of racial overtones.
Oh, yeah.
So our hope was kind of to fight our own need to do and really receive in the form of story, in the form of experience, in the form of learning, advice for our own country.
Yeah.
How to be better human beings?
Wow, man, that's like really amazing. And you wanted to say something?
Yeah, James? Drew, you actually said something when we were speaking outside, and it actually struck a chord with me. Whereby at the Nelson Mandela Foundation, you asked Jay Naidu to give you advice about how you could be of service, and you also asked the CEO of the Steve Biko Foundation how you can be of service. Please tell us both responses and how you received that.
Yeah, from the Steve Biko Foundation, I'm still undeclared, figuring out what I want to study. So I thought, what a great place to ask for advice. You know, what can I study to be of better service, to improve our world? And the leader of the Steve Biko Foundation had a great response. She said, honey, you know, with all due respect, we're not looking for your help. Like, you helping is not actually how people are going to work themselves out of positions of poverty or injustice or racism. So I guess I wanted to change my answer, and I asked, you know, Uncle Jay, how can I effectively get out of the way to some degree, or what can my role be in this sort of globalized community? And he had a great response. He said, you know, we were there for several hours, and you know, you Americans didn't ask a question, didn't say anything. That's a great,
that's a great,
great job. Yeah, the Americans are changing their identity. So that was a big learning, that for a country that does a lot of talking, maybe a good next step would be listening.
I love that. I absolutely love
that's,
that.
That's actually quite awesome.
Yeah, listen.
This is going to be going on for a while, isn't it? Anyway, and what have you heard, Drew? What do you feel you've heard? I mean, I feel like for many years, and this has been like the narrative, you know, globally, that the US comes in to any area to offer
assistance
and help. But that help is very costly because it comes...
economically costly.
Yes, economically costly. It's like, okay, we'll help you out. We'll dig a few wells and a few ditches and build a few roads.
And we'll profit 70% from that.
And then we'll take like all your natural resources.
Yeah. Or we'll write college applications about the experience and get into an Ivy League school.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But nonetheless, I mean, having said that, what do you feel that you should be doing differently as young people? Because I think your hearts are in the right place. And maybe you can go back and tell other young people who are in a place and a position to help, how they can help from your from your story. So what do you think you can tell them?
I think it's been really important to realize, you know, the Rainbow Nation hasn't arrived yet.
Yeah, we're still in the wilderness, buddy.
And I think the rainbow world isn't necessarily a whole lot closer. And I think it's easy, especially with programs like this, to assume, wow, you know, people of different races coming to talk. And I think it's easy to sort of call that a success. And I think I want to be really, really realistic about not there yet. And I think, you know, a big fear for a lot of the sort of the Caucasian white populace of the U.S., the fear of being considered the ignorant white racist in person. That doesn't seem to be a big fear on social media, the fear of being the ignorant white racist often prevents people from even asking the question. Admitting the fact that I may not know someone else's story, you have to accept the fact that you are white. Yeah. And I think it's something it's easy to sort of assume that that's a neutral color.
Oh, yeah.
Sort of assume.
We're all the same.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And it's super easy, sort of as a person with white background, it's super easy to think, well, this is neutral and other people are different and I love difference. And that's a very insidious place to begin from.
It's kind of like the saying when everyone used to go around saying, I don't see color. And everyone would be like, yeah. And so we realized that if you don't see color, you can't acknowledge someone else's pain, right?
That's right, exactly.
What do you want to add, Michael?
Yeah, I think sort of as Drew noted too, well, first of all, I don't think we'll ever fully be able to understand everyone's story.
Yes.
And as much as through social media, understanding someone's story in 140 characters seems quick and efficient. I'd like to hope that we could dive a little deeper, such that while we may recognize sort of the distinctiveness of each person by diving deeper in their story, it's the intention of learning how that story fits into this oneness, this global narrative, and it's how the role it plays is really an act of love, that form of listening, of the intensity of attention to someone, such that hopefully together we can stop shortening people's stories to 140 characters, because I think that's inherently dehumanizing.
I don't know if you guys see it the same way. Maybe I'm just like a bit of an older generation, but I mean, growing up, although we grew up, I grew up under apartheid. There was like no two ways about it. That was real. It was like law. It was legislated. And maybe fortunately, having gone to like multiracial schools and you know, behind the fence, we had our issues. But generally, there was this sense of potential.
Okay.
That anything can happen, that one day we'll get this right. And in the meantime, let's keep trying to work at it and find each other as different races. That I don't know if I'm feeling from young people at the moment. I feel like young people are at a point now where they're like, nah, like, let's not. It's not going to get better. Life is always going to be like this. We're never going to understand each other as different races. So let's not even try.
Do you think that's the case, though? Sorry, guys. I'll give you guys an answer to, chance
that's
to answer.
That's what I'm seeing as someone older.
You honestly know what? I'm feeling, and I don't know if you guys are feeling this, but I feel that we are tired of pretending. We are all tired of walking around the world, putting on these masks and pretending that everything is the way that we are told it is, yet experiencing life differently. You know, and I mean, you're Filipino, right, Michael? And I mean, I'm sure you have experienced certain setbacks.
Definitely.
Because of your nationality, because you're not purely white. And Drew, I'm sure you've experienced certain elements of either people really disliking you because you're white, or having an advantage in society because you're white. And I think all of us as the youth are sitting back and saying, but wait, there's something here. We are all being told, love each other, yay, we're great, we can date other races. Yet when I step into society, when I step into the workforce, my reality is very different to what I'm being told. Is that the feeling you guys get?
Yeah, I think back to the idea of hope. I think it that requires a degree of responsibility.
Yes, I like
that. And that involves work.
Mm.
And I think young people feel burdened by, you know, the finding myself and really sort of this. I think social media kind of encourages it, that in the absence of sort of a global vision or a vision for South Africa or whatnot, we replace it with what makes me happy.
Oh, yeah.
That I think in the inability to answer big questions, we answer the questions we think we can. And one of the most fundamental ones is what makes me happy.
Mm.
And I think that's actually something we teach our children to pursue.
Yes.
To their own detriment.
Oh, yeah.
That I think as soon as we make ourselves our own goal, we're actually...
Wow.
Making
you are so wise.
I just think it's actually a disadvantage.
Wow.
A disadvantage. But I would love to follow that with a question to both of you.
Yes.
What should we be hearing? I know it's Soweto. It's great to be in, but I think another reality is it's very specific stories. I don't want to pretend that's South Africa by any stretch of the means. So what?
It's you know what? Soweto, if you're open to it, can be quite quite a variety of different stories. One, for one, it's got, I think, a wide variety of different types of people. Mm-hmm. Especially when I say that, I mean different tribes of black people living in one place. So you might hear the story of the Shangaan people that you might not get anywhere else. You might hear the story of Zulu people, Sotho people, Tswana people, Pedi people, and so on and so forth. And also, I think more than any other township, it's one of those townships that is very popular with tourists.
And it's the biggest. Yeah.
And it's the biggest. And it's got a lot of history behind it. But just listen to the people right now. Mm. I think that's the biggest thing, and not necessarily just the history of it and be taken up by the hype. What are their day-to-day struggles? And I think that's what Candace and I have been kind of talking about in the beginning of this show today.
Yes.
Which is, they're very real struggles that are still happening for the people that are living there.
Definitely.
You know, that things have not changed 23 years into this whole democracy thing, or 22 years into democracy and having legislative freedom but not economic freedom. And I think the biggest thing that I'm finding about maybe young people right now is, without economic freedom, we can never have real freedom.
Yeah.
And that's a worldwide thing.
Yeah.
Until we're all on the same playing field, where even the Western countries are starting to say, you know what, when we come to your country and we are being benevolent, we really mean that. You can trust us because we are benevolent. We want a win-win situation. And I think maybe that's a global economic thing that's been happening for a long time in general, where it's been about, in any business transaction, there must be a winner and a loser, which doesn't make any sense at all. Because why can't there be a winner and a winner?
No, but can I just say, I think the biggest problem, though, is, I'm sorry, Drew, we're deviating from your question altogether, but I feel, going back to the original statement of the youth being more hopeless than ever, I feel that's actually different. I feel the youth are more hopeful than ever. The difference is, now we are taking our own lives into our own hands. And what we are doing is, we are saying we are tired of paying high fees for education. Until we can be equally educated at the same playing field, we cannot compete in the global market, number one. Therefore, economic freedom is always going to evade us. Number two, I feel that in Soweto, you know, I mean, there are diverse stories, there are diverse communities within that larger, you know, Soweto area, whereby you do get the bottom, like, you know, people who unfortunately just have no economic power at all, and they're still washing in the buckets, and they still, and then you get households that are like, you know, in Orlando East, is it Orlando East that's a bit more affluent?
Deep Kloof Extension,
where now it's the
East
more
as well, Pimville,
yeah, you know, then you get the cool more affluent places. Areas where, but people have made it, and they now they like just chilling, and they're like, okay, cool, now I've made it, but you know, I just need more of this money, kind of thing. So I feel that the youth are being more proactive today. They're just not accepting. They're not just accepting that, oh, okay, no, you know, I'm just going to accept that, yeah, we're free. You know, I'm going to hug every white person when I leave this and feel good about myself. I'm going to kiss black children and feel good about myself, you know. We are saying that if we are going to move forward, this is how, the most effective way, so that it can actually be maintained, you know. And I feel that that's actually, we're living in the most exciting time, you know. What do you guys think?
I was
having like a one-woman show there.
No, I think you make a great point, especially with the hope. It's interesting though to see how, whether or not that's can be transformed to individual or the community as a whole, especially as you noted, when media sometimes promotes hope for our own happiness, and almost as if we plaster those who are successful and who are thrown as a virtue of goodness or those who are successful. And I'd hope, especially for us as we dive deeper into stories and the intersection of our own story as well, that we can find where that hope can be almost transformed and flipped around back onto the youth, and so that's where that goodness comes from.
But you guys are really making me excited. I mean, the fact that you are 19, you left the comfort of your home and you came to South Africa to experience
well.
And expand your mind.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's so easy. You come from a land that, honestly, I don't think there's a better self-promoter than the United States of America. I mean, I feel like you could go
the
anywhere.
United States.
Yeah, you can go anywhere in America and people will be like, I love America. You know what I'm saying? You guys are like a world amongst yourself. And the fact that you came out and you said, I'm tired. I'm tired of the reality that's being projected onto me. I want to go find more, because there has to be more. And you can go back and you can be a message. And not only a message, but just your being will be so different that you will inspire, you know, those around you. And I feel like that's how the youth need to start living, a more inspired life. And I love you guys for that.
Yeah, and I think that you guys are inspiring. I mean, you've inspired me.
So inspiring.
I think
and
some
so
of the things
smart.
That you said, Drew, when you say, if you look at only your own happiness, you can actually never be truly happy, can you?
Oh, my goodness.
Because then everything is based on how you feel about your reality right now.
Mm.
But if you take that and you say, actually, I'm concerned more about other people's happiness first, then there's a better chance that you actually might be cool.
Yeah.
You might be all right.
You're looking at life as a collective.
And if I could just add, I agree with you that it's an exciting time to be in, but something we've talked about in Soweto, the young people, a lot of people, it's great to say this is such an exciting time and we are the generation that's going to make a difference. My one concern is that I feel like most generations before us, even generations in power, were saying very similar things.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
So our big question is what will make us different?
Hmm.
What will prevent our corruption?
Yeah. It will be this. These kind of dialogues, these kind of conversations,
guys,
and these kind of leaders.
Don't give up on the ideal. Because sometimes it seems like ideals. But the reality is life will try and change your perspective
and
your beliefs. But the winner is the one who hangs on
until
to that very crazy ideal that everyone says will never actually happen and makes it happen. At the end of the day, if you want to change society, you just have to hang on to what you believe in. And life is about what you believe. Whatever you believe will be that in your life. It will be realized.
Yeah.
And if you have no belief to start with, then life will just happen to you.
Yeah.
So I encourage you guys to just
keep doing
believing
what you're doing.
That you can make a difference.
Mm. Because you're already making a difference. And
yeah,
I feel that don't underestimate your contribution just because you think, because it's very difficult to view yourself how others would view you, but don't ever underestimate it and think, oh my gosh, this is a bigger struggle than I can be alone, because you're not alone. As soon as small little people out there are thinking to themselves, I need to make a difference, and they're doing active things within their lives, then all of us collectively are actually rising, and we're even raising the people that aren't really doing anything but are getting inspired by just watching. But guys, oh my gosh, that was so much fun. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's an honor and pleasure.
And yeah.
You were great today. Thank you for that. You want to close the show for us?
I
have some words to say for of hope.
From South Africa's favorite person. You don't want to say anything? You sure?
Well, no, I'm going to say this. I think with what these guys have said as well, Drew and Michael, I'm very proud of you guys for what you're doing, by the way. And from my side, it's a matter of whatever my story can teach you is just sometimes you have to stand for what you believe and go with that.
Yeah.
Because it's better to stand for something and have your mind change later than just have not stood for anything at all.
What's the Winston Churchill quote? Let's leave it with that. I'd rather have the whole world against me than my own soul.
There you go, baby.
Amen. Have a good one, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in.
Stand up so the people can see you before we go.
It's radio. Bye.
This is CliffCentral.com.